If you've ever written a cover letter or a resume, there's a good chance you found the entire process a whole lot of work with an uncertain outcome. There are plenty of websites and resources devoted to helping you build the perfect application, but let's face it, does anybody really know what works and what doesn't?
Well, if you felt that way, take some comfort. Our next guest says researchers have finally built up enough solid science about human decision-making to confirm a belief held by many on both sides of the hiring equation. It's time for the resume and the cover letter to die, and there could be some promising alternatives out there.
We're joined now by Jesse Singel. He's a journalist and the editor of the Science of Us blog at New York Magazine. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I'm assuming that when people see the title of the article you wrote for New York Magazine, it's called Kill the Cover Letter and Resume. A lot of people are pretty psyched about that idea. As job applicants, why do you think these things can be so painful?
I think it's partly the idea that, you know, I'm writing this cover letter and resume. I know everyone else applying for the job is writing it in the exact same format. So people desperately try to stand out, and it's very hard to do that. It's very hard to envision, you know, these hours of work just going into this pile and perhaps never even being seen by another human being.
How do employers feel about the resume and cover letter packet?
My sense is, like, HR departments don't really like them at all. I mean, I talked to some folks where in academic departments where they would put out a job call for, you know, an associate professor or something, and they would get 1,000 applicants, many from people not in academia. And the problem there is because you can just sort of copy and paste your info from job to job and apply pretty easily, there's not a very high threshold. You'll get a lot of applicants who might not even know what the job entails and who just clearly aren't qualified for it, which wastes a lot of human resource time.
So if both employers and employees, potential employees, seem to feel that this is kind of an onerous task that doesn't necessarily yield a lot by way of guidance, why has this process persisted for so long?
I think, well, first of all, it rose in a sort of different time when we didn't have email, we didn't have LinkedIn, we didn't have the technology we have today. But I talked to a lot of folks who expressed skepticism about the idea of doing anything else because they think anything else would take more time. They can't really envision a system that's different or more efficient. So I think we're under this collective delusion that this is an efficient way to go about things. And, you know, it's one of those groupthink situations where everybody does it, no one can imagine another system, so we're stuck with a system that doesn't work very well.
So in terms of sort of the pitfalls of the cover letter resume way to go, one problem that you talk about is that it has a lot of potential to be discriminatory. How so?
Yeah, I think my whole case against the cover letter and resume can be summed up in one word, and that's bias. So on the one hand, a lot of us are familiar with this idea that if you send out resumes with stereotypical white names and black names but equal credentials, you will see that the people with white names get more calls in for interviews. And that's just sort of straight up racial discrimination. What I had been less familiar with before I looked into this was the extent to which all these little facts you put in your resume, what school you went to, what town you went to, stuff that we wouldn't consider to be sort of fodder for discrimination, that can also lead to discrimination. Because there's evidence that if I look at one writing sample from someone who says they're from Harvard, for example, and another writing sample from someone at a small state school, I'm going to grade them on very different curves. I'm going to give the advantage to the person who already has the advantage by coming from a big school.
And that's plays out how? You think, oh, the guy from Harvard, he made a few spelling errors. He must have been working really hard. And you think something else for the next guy?
Yeah, exactly. That's what one of the researchers told me in the article, is the way we interpret things like a spelling mistake on a resume or cover letter. You know, there was one great recent study, I say great with scare quotes around it, where people who evaluated a piece of writing actually found more spelling errors when they were told the author was black. And these probably aren't people who express sort of overt racial hostility. This is just a lot of stuff that is going on under the surface of our minds, so we might not be aware of.
So that's one aspect, the racial discrimination that seems to be true across the board. But then there was another study that you reference where people approached a professor and they were only likely to get, you know, the desired response if they were a white male. What happened there?
Yeah, so I think this was basically just a professor at, I believe, UPenn, sent out a bunch of you know, I think folks who have been to college know you'll occasionally email a professor in that sort of young person, naive kind of way saying, hey, can you help me out with this? So this researcher sent out a bunch of emails to, I think, business professors from fake students with different names. And the students, any student who didn't have a name that sounded white and sounded male got a lower response rate, meaning these were students hypothetically like doing everything they can to actually reach out and make connections, and they were stymied, this study suggests, just because of their race or their gender.
Right, so this looks at bias against women and anyone who wasn't Caucasian at the same time. So what is the solution to this? What direction do we have to turn?
Yeah, well, I can see different employers taking up different solutions. Like, if you just want to tweak the system a little bit, one very easy thing you could do is just hide certain details. Like, set up an online application system where hiring managers evaluate a resume, but don't see what town they're from, don't see their name at first, don't see the applicant's college, for example. I mean, if you're really looking to see, oh, they have 3 years of experience in this one kind of job in the past, that should be all you see. You shouldn't see the stuff that could introduce bias.
And another possible solution came from the way a symphony orchestra handled the possibility of bias in their auditions. How did they crack that one?
Yeah, this is sort of the first study any psychologist you talk to about bias in hiring will reference. Basically, there was a point at which this sort of old boys club had developed where musicians would bring their proteges into symphony orchestras, and those proteges tended to be male. So a lot of orchestras started introducing a screen during the audition process where the people deciding who would join the orchestra wouldn't even see who was playing the music. They would just hear it. And what the researchers found was that, you know, when they ran the numbers, statistically, this screen accounted for a big increase in the proportion of women in symphony orchestras. Meaning if there hadn't been a screen, these women would have been discriminated against just on the basis of their gender.
So that gets at what you were suggesting before, just sort of blanking out some of the information so it's not even on the table.
Yeah, exactly. I think we overestimate our ability to juggle all this information to do something useful with it. I think we assume more information is always better, and there are a lot of cases where less is better.
And one of the things that's interesting about all this is that, you know, at the end of the day, researchers think that this cover letter resume isn't even a good predictor of what skills an applicant has. What do we know about that?
Right. Well, here's where it gets a little bit complicated, because there are some things on there that could be useful. But when you just look at credentials, when you just look at sort of the name brands people try to stuff into their resume and cover letter, and I know because I've done the same thing, that's not a good predictor of whether or not someone will do well at a given job. And I think we all know this sort of anecdotally. I mean, we know people who have fancy connections or somehow went to some great school but who just aren't very talented at what they do. So my basic argument is we shouldn't be hiring based on went to what school. We should be hiring based on who can do the job well.
And how do we do that? How do we get at a process that matches the best applicant to the job?
It depends on sort of how concrete of an output the job requires. For something like journalism, it's pretty easy to imagine how you could do that. I mean, if I were hiring sort of a writer to work under me, I'd say, look, here's a study. Write it up. What kind of questions would you ask the researcher? Or find me some studies to write about. You know, how do you do social science writing when I put you on the spot, when I ask you to just produce? And you could evaluate those writing samples without knowing anything about their demographics, which I think would be preferable.
And what about when we're looking beyond writing at a particular skill set, say?
Right. So it gets a little bit trickier here. There, basically, researchers have found there are these sort of personality inventories. I've got a couple of sample items in front of me. There are these sort of stable, well-known personality traits. There's things like extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, and different ones of these apply to different jobs. So if you had someone who is a party planner, you don't want them to be a quiet introvert, for example, for obvious reasons. So there's, you could give people, I know it always sounds creepy and Orwellian at first, even when I say it, but if you give an anonymous personality inventory at first, that could actually help you sift out who could be good or bad at this job and not introduce the elements of human bias I'm talking about.
An anonymous personality profile. So you have to take, you know, like a Myers-Briggs sort of thing to tell you the sort of person who would work well in your position?
Yeah, I think there are some jobs where that would actually be a good solution. And I'm not saying you completely sift the pile just based on this one step. But as a first step, that would be better than the first step of having 1,000 cover letters and resumes I think that would actually be preferable in a lot of cases. But it varies hugely from job to job in terms of which sort of personality inventories you'd use.
We're talking right now with journalist Jesse Singel. In a recent article, he makes the case that it's finally time to kill off the cover letter and resume.
And we want to hear from you on this as employees and employers. Do you like this idea? If you hate the cover letter and the resume, why? Have you sweated trying to write these, only knowing that there was a limited chance they were going to do anything for you? Or do you want to make the case that this is a good way, the cover letter, the resume, to evaluate a potential employee? Is there another way, a better way to do it? Have you encountered it in your professional life? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with journalist Jesse Singel of New York Magazine. He says it's time to get rid of the cover letter and resume and find alternatives that give more information without the possible bias.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. When you've applied for work, have you dreaded writing the cover letter, hated laboring through it? As an employer, do you hate having to go through all those cover letters and resumes, or do you think there's a lot of value in there? And how about the whole bias element? Do you think that people might look at your resume and cover letter and be biased against you because of your name, where you are from, where you went to school? Call in at 800-642-1234, or if you have a better idea, a way to replace the cover letter and the resume. Let us know that too. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go right to our phones and take a call from Nancy in Appleton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
What do you think?
My comment wanted to discuss the point that was made about using personality tests as a possible alternative. And I wanted to let you know that the Myers-Briggs outfit that certifies people, and I'm a certified Myers-Briggs facilitator, really states that that is not ethical use of the personality inventory. I know there's other personality inventories, and it's a kind of industry that's developed for job screening. But as a counselor in this field, I really think that introduces another bias. The difficulty with using these personality inventories in this way is that they ignore the fact that people develop competencies and skills that are outside of their maybe main preferences, and therefore they would be discriminated against with a personality inventory. It'd be very discriminatory, especially for introverts who often are discriminated in job interviews, but have developed skills. For example, we all have to be brave sometimes when we don't feel like being brave, or we have to be quiet when we don't feel like being quiet. And those skills and competencies are developed, and that's what should be tested for, not their underlying personality preferences or traits.
Okay, thanks for the thoughts, Nancy. Appreciate that. Nancy raising some questions about the idea of using a personality profile. And we do live in a society that tends to lean toward extroverts. Maybe that's something to consider then when we talk about at least that aspect of it. What do you think, Jesse?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. I should say that I didn't talk to any researchers who thought that you should do one test or one personality inventory, and that should determine who gets what job. The idea was always that you would use at least a couple of them in conjunction with other factors, at least to sift. That said, I mean, I'm sort of just reporting what I found, and I didn't talk to the folks associated with actually selling these tests themselves. I talked to organizational researchers who have really run the numbers at what does correlate with good job performance, and they seem to think that there is some predictive validity here.
And we're taking your calls right now, wondering if you think that the old cover letter and resume combo is a good reflection of how qualified someone is for a job? Or do you think that it hasn't worked well for you and that maybe it disadvantages you in some way, maybe based on your race or your gender or your interests? What do you think? And what should we do instead if we're not using the cover letter and resume? What do you think could take its place and do a good job of it? And we have a comment on Facebook from Dave who says, as an employer, I still like them, meaning the cover letter resume. I want to hire someone with an eye for detail and an attention span long enough to complete one. And I've seen way too many haphazard and half-hearted attempts at applying for employment. So there is something selecting about someone who actually does slog through the process of the cover letter resume. In a way, does that weed out some people right there?
Well, I think so, but the downside of that is, and I say this as someone who's had to look through cover letters and resumes, you end up having to go through 8 ones that are clearly not qualified for everyone that's, you know, even a possibility. That's why one of the things I argue from the article is to make it a little bit tougher, actually, to apply to certain jobs. I mean, would you rather have 800 applicants of whom 50 of them are qualified or 100 applicants of whom 50 are qualified? I just think there's more efficient ways to go about it.
And our number, 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And we'll go next to Mark, joining us in Door County. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'm a graduate student and a photojournalist, and I found the comments about writing samples interesting. There's not really a good way to do that for photojournalists. We build portfolios and send those off as well as cover letters and resumes. But when I was applying for a lot of internships this past summer, I applied for about 35. I just noted how long it took me to cater my cover letters to each individual employer, the size of the business, the market, and how much time that took away from me working on other skills that I think that the employer probably would have found more interesting and had been reflected in my portfolio or other areas.
All right. Thank you for that, Mark. And Mark, sort of getting at this idea that it might not be a good use of time, that there might be, for example, a test of actual, you know, work samples that an employee might have to complete on the job. That might be a better indicator.
Yeah. Well, I think photojournalism is a perfect example because none of these places would have been hiring him because he can write a good cover, a letter, a resume. They'd be hiring him because he knows how to take good photographs. So why not just look at the photographs he took and judge it based on that?
And what about the HR department? If we branch off from the standard, which has been with us for so long, is this going to create logistical nightmares for HR departments?
Yeah, no, I would think it definitely would at first. I mean, you imagine any sort of sea change in how business is usually done. But, you know, the whole argument is that it would be worth the price of a little bit of chaos to get a better system in place.
And in terms of the interview itself, is there any data in on what works for an interview? Is it better to just sit down and, you know, shoot the breeze with your potential employers? Or is it good to have a formal interview process?
Yeah, there is a very loud consensus within sort of the psychological community that a so-called unstructured interview where you just sit down and shoot the breeze is literally the worst thing you can do. There was one study in the Harvard Business Review where they wrote it up where some sort of test of the employee's capabilities, like a simple algorithm where you have a computer judge how good they'd be for the position, that did better than mixing the algorithm with an unstructured interview. An unstructured interview is sort of a biased nightmare. I mean, you get all these, oh, he's a good guy, he's smart, he looked me in the eye, he shook my hand well. None of that stuff actually matters for how good someone can be at a job. And yeah, it's a bias explosion.
Let's take another call. We have Carl next in Rochester. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I found that employers didn't even want the people with experience. Even in such applications as of positions where experience would think naturally that it would be a plus.
Why wouldn't an employer
being able to solve problems, et cetera, in your experience? And they totally the contrary.
And why would that be, Carl?
One time, I even went as far as to fill out 2 different applications. One, like, I just wandered off the street, and another one where, okay, I've got a little bit of experience and that relates to the job. And the one with no experience, no nothing, you just stumbled off the street, got an interview.
All right. Thank you, Carl, for that. And different things could be going on there. Maybe somebody wants an employee who doesn't have as much experience. Maybe you don't have to pay them as much. Different factors going into that transaction there. What kind of biases do you think are most important to get rid of, do you think, as we look at this, Jesse?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously you don't want any racial bias. I think people, especially given the student debt crisis, it's harder and harder to graduate from like a big name brand school that's expensive. So I think we should be giving folks who didn't have access to that kind of education as much of a chance as anyone to show they can do a job well. So I think, you know, we have a lot of big sweeping talk about inequality, but this is how inequality plays out. Like in terms of individual hiring decisions and the systems we use to pick who gets what job and who doesn't.
Jesse, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Jesse Singel. He's a journalist and the editor of the Science of Us blog at New York Magazine.